You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson. And what is it about Louisiana politics that attracts a lifelong Midwesterner like me? For years, I've had an interest in the politics of this state and have enjoyed some excellent books on some of the leading figures, like Huey Long, his brother Earl Long, and his son, former Senator Russell Long. Is it the combination of leaders and even rogues that fascinates me that's similar to my state of Illinois? Is it the unique culture and heritage that makes Louisiana unique and different from other southern states? I'm not sure myself, but I've thoroughly enjoyed the journey. My guest today has written an outstanding new book on his life that captures much of what makes Louisiana so interesting. And I think listeners will maybe see what I mean when you've heard my guest talk a little bit today. It's my privilege to have Robert Mann as my guest. His new book is called Backrooms and Bayous, My Life in Louisiana Politics. He's written several other books that we'll touch on a little later. He's had a very interesting life in different areas and occupations. And I'm really pleased to have you on my show today, Bob.
Thank you, Robin. It's a delight to be with you.
Well, before we get into some of the fascinating aspects of your life, and as all good biographies, it's very good at incorporating other events from history in it. But what you reached a stage in your life where you thought this type of book would be worthwhile, and I'm glad you thought that. But what led to that as far as the reasons for writing the book?
Well, it was several. One, I have two children who are they're both 22 now. They're seniors here at Louisiana State University, and they've only known me as a college professor. Really, I came to teach at LSU political communication when they were about six or seven. And so Dad's always been this kind of boring college professor. And I wanted them to know that I had another more interesting, maybe more interesting, but a life before all that. I wanted them to know. I've written a lot of other books, and most of them are political history. I'm a historian, and I sort of delve into people's lives, and one of the most valuable things that I find in my research is a good, either published or unpublished memoir of someone's life that tells the details of their childhood and what formed them and all of that. And I just felt like that I owed it to my children and my hopefully eventual grandchildren to put some of these stories down about the interesting people that I worked for and knew and what I saw before the colors faded. I had a number of friends over the years that I urged them to write a memoir or at least sit down with an oral historian and tell their stories, and they died with their stories. And I just resolved that would not happen with me.
Your first career was in journalism.
I started out, graduated college with a journalism degree and worked all the way through, partly through high school and all the way through college as a radio disc jockey and then a radio journalist. And then after graduation, went into newspapers and worked as a political government writer for a couple of newspapers in North Louisiana. And got my feet wet in covering campaigns. And I already loved politics, but riding around the state in the back of the car with a former governor, Edwin Edwards, watching it up close and seeing how things played out really, really got me interested in wanting to get involved in politics in a different way.
You know, you mentioned, and I flagged this right off the bat, because I live outside of a small town. You talked about the importance of covering a small town for a newspaper, which was key to your journalistic career. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Well, you know, I was, so the first newspaper job I had was for the Monroe News Star World, which was in Monroe, Louisiana, northeast Louisiana, Gannett paper, then and now. And, you know, this was in the early 80s when even a small-town newspaper like that had a pretty good staff, and they sent me over to Ruston, Louisiana, which is about 30 miles west of Monroe. And I was the bureau chief for a four-parish in Louisiana. As you know, our counties are called parishes. I was covered a four-parish area for the Monroe paper. And I spent a year over there covering a little bit of everything. I mean, one day I'd be covering a car wreck. The next day I would be, covering a murder trial. I would be covering a football games on Friday night. I might be covering a small town city council meeting. I mean, it was just every day was a different story. Every day was a different challenge of how to tell my readers about what happened and learn a new skill. And, I also had, this was the days before the internet, before email, before even cell phones. So I'd be down in Winfield covering the city council meeting or whatever. And it was too late to drive back to Ruston and write my story. I had to find a phone booth. And, what was his name? Superman, Jimmy, whatever. And, I'd be in the phone booth and instead of changing clothes, I'd be calling some clerk in the newsroom and literally dictating the story from my notepad. And it was I learned so much. I am a very fast writer now. I can sit down and just bang something out. I can dictate a story if I had to, because I learned all of that. And I've always told my students that, don't take an internship with a big newspaper, because they'll have you fetching coffee or doing one little small thing. Go work for a small town newspaper, a weekly paper, because they'll make you do everything, and you'll learn skills that will serve you well for the rest of your life and the rest of your career.
Well, I'm sure the trends down there are the same up here, where we've had the demise of a lot of these small town papers, and I think that's really negatively impacted our democracy.
Oh, it has. That paper, that news, the New Star that I worked for in Monroe, when I was there, 30, 35 reporters for that paper. Today, I think they have maybe two or three, four, covering the whole part of that region. The other paper I worked for, the Shreveport Journal, no longer exists. It went out of business. And every one of those papers, they're going out of business. That's just fewer reporters snooping around, finding wrongdoing and looking at what these politicians are up to. I think that it's bad for our democracy, and it's bad for just public accountability of our elected officials.
How did you get from covering politics to being right in the mix? Did you ever envision that, and how did that come about?
Well, I tell in the book about early on in my summer between my freshman and sophomore years, going back home to Leesville, a little small town where I went to high school, and working on volunteering for a congressional campaign. And, I kind of got in trouble there, made some of the locals mad at me, including the sister-in-law of the eventual person who won the congressional race. But it really, it was exciting. Even though I got in trouble, even though I had to, as I tell the story, I had to call the police on to come save me at one point, it was exhilarating. It was a lot of fun. And I just knew that it was something that I didn't know that I would go to Washington and work in politics for 20 years and have a really fulfilling career working for a bunch of, U.S. senators and a governor. But I just knew that it was something that I wanted to do, and I wasn't sure how I was going to do it. But I just knew instinctively politics is going to be a part of my life from a very early age. Even before that, my parents were not political people, but they were interested in politics, and there was always a newspaper, there were always books in our house, and there was always talk about politics. My mother was big on writing to the local congressman, and it was thrilling to see that he would write her back, and she was having this conversation with him about the issues, and it just was always something that was going on in and around my family home.
You and I are from the same era, so I hope everybody will recognize the name of Russell Long out there. If you're younger, you should probably learn a little bit more about him. He was one of the titans of the U.S. Senate back 60s, 70s, even before then. And you had the great chance to work with him and even write about him.
Yeah, I just sort of stumbled into that job. I wasn't looking to work in D.C. at the time. I was just up there doing some reporting, and I learned that he was looking for a press secretary, and I went in just on a lark, kind of, and volunteered to interview for the job, and ended up getting it. And So I'm 20, I guess I was 26, 27 years old, working for the second most senior member of the Senate, and the son of Huey Long, the son of, you know, the legendary U.S. Senator and Governor of Louisiana. And it was that year that I went to work for him in 85 was the 50th anniversary of his father's assassination in September of 1935. And Senator Long called me in pretty early on and said, I want a speech that I can give on the Senate floor to commemorate my father's death. And he kind of looked at me like he wanted me to write it. And I said, I can't do that. You know, I just can't write a speech about your father like that. But I had this idea that I could interview. I certainly knew how to interview people. So I said, why don't we just sit down and I'll interview you and we'll turn these interviews into a speech. I'll massage them into a speech for you. And he thought that was a good idea. So here I am, just, you know, new in Washington, and part of my job, they're actually paying me to spend hours and hours just chatting with Russell Long about Huey Long. It still is the most interesting, probably the most interesting and thrilling 6 months of my life, because it was just a dream come true for a kid who grew up around politics and understood some of this history and was fascinated by it to have that chance and to have the thrill of seeing the all that work turned into what I think was a pretty significant speech. It was Senator Long's sort of last time to have any real say about his father's legacy.
Well, you know what I flagged there? You pointed out that how good Senator Long was in using humor in difficult situations, yeah. Which, boy, that's a lost art in our politics today. There seems to be no humor left.
Yeah, you know, he really was. He was like a lot of other politicians of that era, that where they liked to warm up a crowd by telling a joke that had sort of a moral to it. But what Long did, I think more effectively, was that he recognized that the work of government couldn't get done when people were shouting at each other, or people were distrusting each other, or people were not listening to one another because of whatever uncomfortable situation it was. So Long had this way of, whenever things got really tense in the Senate Finance Committee or even in a meeting with somebody, he would just sort of rear back and just say, you know, that reminds me of a story. And he would tell a joke. And he would have everybody laughing, and they would forget what they were mad about. He had a really good way of disarming people with his humor. But he wasn't doing it because he just wanted to entertain. He was doing it because he wanted to lower the temperature in the room. And, you know, as you say, you don't see people doing that much anymore. It's just not, it's kind of a lost art.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson. And my guest today is author, professor, former aide to some pretty significant U.S. senators and the governor. His name's Bob Mann, Robert Mann. His most recent book is called Backrooms and Bayous, My Life in Louisiana Politics. And he's helping me understand, and perhaps listeners understand, why I've always been a student of Louisiana politics. He's been talking a little bit about his background in journalism, the transition to politics. And I thought, you know, John Breaux is another name that I recognized from the 1980s, 1970s and 80s. And a guy who, again, unlike our politics today, believed in working with the opposite party.
Yeah, I've never known anybody who was so committed to that. In fact, I was talking to Senator Breaux the other day, and he was telling me, you know, Bill Cassidy is our senior U.S. senator from Louisiana, Republican. And Breaux was telling me that when Cassidy became a senator, after he's elected to the Senate, he called Senator Breaux, who was by then retired from the Senate, and just said, "Yeah, look, I'm interested in your advice. You served 30 years in Congress. What would you say that I should do?" And Breaux told him, and Cassidy has done this, I think, to some degree. He says, "Go find a couple of Democrats. Go find a couple of people of the opposite party and do your best to try to figure out ways you can work with them." And Cassidy's done that, and that's why Cassidy is one of these leaders in the effort to pass that infrastructure bill in the Senate. And that was Breaux's instinct from the very beginning. I'm going to find people on the other side that I can work with, and we can, you know, build from the center out and get things done. And he did. He always did. He made it a point never to alienate whoever the president was, but especially if the president was a person of the other party. he made it a point to try to find every way he could to work for them. And I think it was, you know, for many reasons. One, he was just instinctively had a sort of bipartisan bent to him. But he also recognized that, you know, at the end of the day, my job performance is going to be judged on what I do for my state. And if I'm just up here making speeches and, you know, pounding on the desk and, you know, maybe getting some good sound bites and getting on, you know, maybe even getting on the local, you know, the network news or the local news, just saying some funny stuff, that really doesn't help anybody. The real judge of my effectiveness is what do I do to make life better for the people that I represent? And that was Breaux's, you know, I watched him for the 17 years that I worked for John Breaux, and he never, that was his North Star, is at the end of the day, but we got to get something done. We got to get something done. And if it takes cutting a deal on this, that, the other, at the end of the day, I want to get something done. I'm not up here to make a point. I'm up here to do my job and do the best I can for my people. And we need more people like that in Washington right now. We just have too many people who are more concerned about getting on MSNBC or Fox News than they are about really delivering for the country or their constituents.
Your career also paralleled with the rise of David Duke, who people remember as coming close to winning a couple of statewide races.
Yeah.
And with a very noxious philosophy. I couldn't help, Bob, as I read this, drawing parallels between his language and appeal and President Trump. You were involved in the efforts to stop his rise as well.
Yeah, you know, as I write in the book, I naively believed that Louisiana and much of the South had sort of moved on from its racist past, and I don't know how I missed it. It was pretty clear that that wasn't the case. But when Duke was elected to the state house right outside of New Orleans, and the late 80s, it really caught everybody's attention. And when he began running for the Senate and looked like he might make a runoff with Bennett Johnston, the incumbent Democrat, it scared a lot of people, including a lot of Republicans who understood how bad it was for their party. But for me in particular, it was about how bad it was for my state and what it would say about Louisiana and the economic consequences for a state that elected a former leader of the Ku Klux Klan as senator or governor would have been just catastrophic. So I was really, you know, happy and proud to come home and spend, you know, 6 months working for Senator Johnston and working to beat David Duke. It really is the service of all the 20 plus years that I worked in Louisiana politics. It's the service that I'm most proud of because I think it was the most important work.
You know, one of the dubious things I guess that Illinois and Louisiana have in common is some problems with ethics around our leaders.
Yeah.
We've had elected officials from both parties, our former Governor George Ryan, and a Republican, and Rod Blagojevich, a Democrat, both wound up in jail. What is it? I often think about that, Bob. I mean, I've been in situations, I worked in government for a number of years, where you're sitting around the table and somebody comes up with a bad idea. And most every time I was involved, somebody would speak up and say no. But is it just that they don't have people like that around them? Or what's your thought on that?
Well, I do think that's part of it. I do think there are certain leaders who do surround themselves with yes men and women who aren't interested in people who are going to tell them, no, that's not a good idea. So I do think that's part of it, and then I think there are really bad characters who just attract bad characters. And I think Edwin Edwards, who was the governor that I referred to earlier that I followed around in my first big political campaign that I covered, and was our governor for four terms, and finally went to prison for 8 years. He just died a couple of months ago, at the age of 93. But Edwards was one of those people. I think he attracted sort of the wrong type of people in a lot of cases. And, you know, he was, there are some states, and maybe Illinois is one of them, you know, other states are like that too, not just Louisiana, but there are some states where people, I think, and I think in Louisiana it's because so much of our government is financed by, and has been financed by a few industries for a long time in Louisiana, by the oil and gas industry. The Louisianians, the average person, just didn't have much skin in the game. Our taxes are low. They still remain pretty low. Other people are sort of paying for government. And so I think it makes people care a little less about how the money's being spent because it's not their money. And so the politicians instinctively understand that and can get away with a lot more, I think.
Your career, you reminded me later in the book of The Godfather and The Godfather 3, where he says, every time I try to get out, they drag me back in. And you're brought back in to work for the first woman governor of Louisiana, Kathleen Blanco, yeah. Which was an interesting story. Share some of that, the highlights of that with
you alluded to something that I think is a theme in the book that was to me important to write about, which was how I recognized that politics, especially political campaigns, brought out some of the worst aspects of my personality. I'm not really that competitive of a person, but you put me in a political campaign and that's where it comes out, and some really bad behavior. And I was not really particularly proud of some of the things that I did when I worked in political campaigns over the years. And I told my wife and some others that if I ever have an inclination to go into another campaign, please stop me. But Senator Roe called me one day and said, I'm sending you over to work for Kathleen Blanco. She was in a runoff for governor. She was our lieutenant governor at the time. And I'm sending you over to, you know, help her win this race. And I didn't want to go, but you know, really didn't have a choice. And we ended up winning the race unexpectedly. And she offered me a job as her communications director on the spot that night. And, I ended up taking it. I ended up becoming her communications director. And it was a completely different job from working for a member of Congress. I had no idea that I would end up being the person who helped her deal with the response to Hurricane Katrina. But I left that job about 6 months after Katrina, not feeling particularly well about the service that I provided to her in the state. But in the book, I try to do as good a job as I can as defending her and defending the state and defending her dogged determination to do the best she could. She got a really bad rap. Kathleen Blanco got a very bad rap after Katrina. And I think that I believe I demonstrate in the book, and I believe I make a pretty strong case for how history really has and is reassessing the role that she played. And, I saw firsthand, and I try to convey that in the book, of the commitment to the state that she exhibited at every step of the way, and how she never gave up. She fought to the very end to get the state back up on its knees. And I think the fact that it did get back up on its feet after Katrina is due largely to her willingness to fight for us all.
I have to ask you, in light of the events of the last couple of weeks, you wrote one of your other books is called A Grand Delusion, America's Descent into Vietnam. And with what's happened in Afghanistan and all the comparisons between Afghanistan and Vietnam, what do you think about those parallels?
Well, it's funny you should ask. I had a student who asked me that yesterday, and I pulled the book off the shelf and said, I'm going to read to you some of what I said. Tell me if you think this if you substitute Afghanistan for Vietnam, if it holds up. And I think in many cases, in many of the points that I made, it did. And I would say that in at least two areas. One, our over reliance on military might to bring about political change. We did that in Vietnam. I think we did that in Afghanistan. We seem to, in this country, and maybe it's just human nature, we seem to think that we can change politics with bombs. We think that we, and in Afghanistan, with drones. And the other parallel, and there are many more, I think, but the other parallel that stands out to me was our unwillingness in Vietnam and Afghanistan to really understand the culture. I mean, there's a reason why we had thousands of interpreters in Afghanistan, because none of our people understood the language. We didn't speak the language. And if you don't speak the language of a country, you really can't understand its culture. And if you don't understand its culture, you don't really understand what you're fighting for. And we just seem to have a fatal attraction to places that we don't really bother to know anything about.
We're running a little short on time. I got a couple minutes here. I do want to mention the other one other important book you wrote. It's called The Walls of Jericho, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Russell, Hubert Humphrey, and the Struggle for Civil Rights. I wanted to end on a question. You teach your students there. You mentioned it. I teach part-time as well. But I was curious. What career advice do you give your students who, I mean, God knows we need more good people to get into politics now more than ever, especially young people. What advice do you give them, if they're those that are interested in embarking on a political career?
Well, I give them the same advice that a guy named Bill Dodd, who was the who was our lieutenant governor many, many years ago, gave to me when I interviewed him for my biography of Russell Long. And he told me, he said, just remember that, you don't become a criminal overnight. It's one bad choice that leads to another bad choice. It's one little compromise that leads to another compromise that leads to another compromise. You know, nobody starts out robbing banks. They all, they rob a candy store and they graduate to banks, and the thing that I try to remember and try to impress upon my students is that it's easier to make that course correction early than late. Watch yourself. Be conscious of what you're doing. Don't compromise your principles, even in the smallest ways early on, because it becomes easier and easier and easier as you go on. And the next thing you know it, you're sitting behind bars, or you've done something that really shames yourself and your family, and you stop that by not ever starting. And that's the advice that I give to my children. That's the advice I give to my students.
Well, the book includes some very honest self-reflection, and I think that's very useful for people, because I think all of us that have been involved in campaigns have dealt with that and this win-at-all-costs mentality you talk about. And so it is important to have an ethical grounding going into this, because it's so easy to stray, especially in politics and other occupations as well.
Well, there's just a lot of people who are going to, if you're working for, it's real easy to say yes to a senator or a governor, it's hard to say no to people in power. And you've got to become comfortable with saying, Senator, I don't think that's a good idea. And if they don't take that advice from you, or they punish you in some way, then I think that's your sign. You need to go find somebody else to work for.
Great advice. Bob Mann's been our guest today. Bob, I really appreciate you coming on. He's the author of Backrooms and Bayous, My Life in Louisiana Politics. Don't be hesitant, because it's a book about a different state or a southern state or whatever. This has a lot of important principles, I think, to applies all over in politics and in life. And so it's a book I recommend. I hope people take a look at it. Bob, thank you again for being my guest. And who knows, I'd like to have you back on sometime again.
It's been a delight, Robin. Would love that. Thank you so much.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.